If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
And welcome to this very special Christmas edition of Empire. With me, Anita Arnand, and
me, William Drumble.
And our very, very special guest, Peter Moore, who in the last episode was just hilarious about the fate of Dalrymple, because we could have had...
Oh, I thought it was a very tragic tale.
I mean, it was a very sad story. It was a bit funny. I mean, but for a flounce, he could have been...
People would be able to spell
my
name.
...a major figure in the history of Discovery, but he didn't. It was James Cook instead who gets this command. He's quite a boring figure compared to Joseph Banks, who is also...
Anita's warming up with Joseph Banks now. We're going to get a lot of pictures of Joseph Banks on Anita's
Instagram.
Quite interesting.
He's a clever man. I like a clever man. Okay, so there they are. When do they actually set sail on the Endeavour?
In August of 1768, they're off, and let's see where we go.
Okay, all right. So I mean, how many people are crewing for them? So they've got Banks as the scientist with the mission. You've got Cook, who is dependable, like the flat bottom boat, quite steady. Mm. How many other crew on this ship?
All told, with the sailors and Banks's party, which is sizable, probably, I don't know, about half a dozen, I'm not sure.
And it's this wonderful little area at the back of the boat.
Yeah, they have
where he's got his little trestle tables and his test tubes and his bottles. And
that's right, So it's probably about just over 90, I think. So if you imagine
90,
what I said
before. It used
before,
to be 15 and now it's 90. You were saying that the old Earl of Pembroke.
They've completely refitted the boat. They put in new floors where it used to be just a big coal hole.
Yeah.
They've cleaned it all up.
Is it comfortable? I mean, or is it quite basic?
Really? Not comfortable in any way that we'd understand comfort, I don't think.
But hammocks, I mean, what are we talking? Master and commander kind of hammocks underneath the
decks? Yeah, the 14 inches regulation hammocks are like banging into each other. They had, I'm trying to remember now, but it was hard work in a way. But I think the most difficult thing about it would be the emotional environment, in a way that you're kind of hemmed up with people without any release.
It's like the Big Brother house. Okay. So, and does the ship sort of change livery? Because now it's this great, you know, royal, by royal command ship. Does it have a figurehead? Does it have like a beautiful kind of livery behind it?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's painted up to look a bit nicer. It gets the, you know, the flag of a naval vessel on commission. But essentially, it's a weird hybrid of a coal ship with this, you know, ephemera of a Royal Navy vessel.
So we always thought of it like a cart horse with lipstick. You know? Yeah. Is that kind of the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you can imagine if you were like someone who knew about ships in that time, they'd look at it and go, what the hell is that? Okay. It's a kind of strange apparition.
But it's the Banks bit of the expedition that you obviously love, because in your account of it, Banks is absolutely centre stage. He arrives at Madeira, the first stop, and he's immediately out there collecting specimens. He's with his butterfly net and everything else.
Well, I mean, this is just a process that doesn't stop. Whenever they get to land, Banks is off. It's like you press a button and it's botanized.
In Madeira, you say 700 specimens in less than 6 days.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's, I can't remember the numbers, but it's illustrative of what they were doing. I mean, Madeira was known. This was like the Watford Gap for, you know, on the way across the Atlantic. What they wanted to do was get out as far away as possible. And Banks had decided he might find some new species.
In Madeira. But it's really a warm-up, isn't it? Just flexing muscles.
On the whole trip, yeah. And you have him in some sort of contraption fishing on the back of the ship, trying to pick up fish.
The Lighterman's skiff, I think it was called. So he'd often be trailing behind when they were becalmed or they were, you know. He didn't stop. And they had this idea, I think, that they would collect in the mornings and they would classify in the afternoons. And if you do read, people who are interested in Enlightenment philosophy, they just read this journal. It's very, very brisk. There's always something happening. He's on to the next thing. His insights are very poetic sometimes. He's got a nice expressive voice, I think, that he uses.
And he's drawing, or his friend Solander is drawing?
He's got a young Scotsman called Sidney Parkinson, who I have to say is my hero because he's...
You're very keen on him, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I like Parkinson because he's a very thoughtful Quaker. He's an introvert. But his journal doesn't survive, but the foul copy of it does. So there's lots of notes which you can put together. I always think that Parkinson's journal is a great lost document.
I bet you went looking for that.
Yeah.
Why is it lost? I mean, just...
I don't know. I think it disappeared in Banks's house afterwards. But anyway, that's a whole different story. But Parkinson is like he's a very humane character as well. So for example, Banks is charging around in Labrador like fashion all the time, whereas Parkinson actually stops to think about what's happening. And so Parkinson will record when one of the sailors dies, for example.
Oh, I see. And Banks doesn't mention it. Well,
if Banks mentions it, it's like we were delayed 2 days by the drowning of this.
It's quite inconvenient. So he's very crass
sometimes. But Parkinson is a considerable artist, and the illustrations that you include in your book. Beautiful botanical paintings.
Yeah.
Okay, so they carry on. They're on the voyage. They've left Madeira. They're getting closer and closer to the equator. But crossing the equator is a really big deal for the Endeavour and crew. Tell us a little bit about that moment.
Well, they had a traditional ceremony at that point.
This is a great thing in all these travel accounts. Crossing the equator was a big deal.
Crossing lines. This isn't particular to Endeavour, but this is one thing that they did observe at the time. And so crossing from the north into the southern hemisphere, they said, required some sort of ceremonial moment. And weirdly, on the Endeavour, there was a very long account of what happened, which involved a subversion of authority. So all of those commissioned officers had to buy themselves off or agree to be ducked by the ordinary seamen. So it's a bit of a bizarre thing which goes on in the middle
be
of
ducked.
The...
Be ducked. I mean, is that exactly what it sounds like?
Yeah.
Doinked under the water.
Yeah, and I think Banks paid himself off and so would Cook, for example.
Right.
I wrote about this in the sense that really in light of what happens later on with things like the Bounty and shipboard management and like how it was important to cohere as a social group in this. These things interest you.
There's a lot of drinking at this point too, isn't there?
Yeah, they drink.
But camaraderie wise, and are you saying that there was a distance between Banks, Cook and the crew, or that actually it was a good thing that there was a distance? I mean, you're describing two men who are slightly aloof.
Yeah.
Is that good or bad on a voyage?
Well, I think
like
one thing that was going to be central to the success of the voyage was the relationship between Cook and Banks.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Cook is just superb. He always rises in people's estimation by degrees, not really by specific acts, but you can just tell when you read the accounts, they say, well, this guy was really good. The way he did this was really clever. Mm-hmm. And he kind of just grows in stature. And you have to remember, at the beginning of this voyage, you have Cook, who is not Captain Cook at this point. He would be called captain by convention by when they were on the ship, but he was a lieutenant by rank. He was very
I took that for granted. Captain Cook. He's always been Captain Cook in my head.
And he was a farm labourer's son from North Yorkshire. He had no status. He had no hereditary honour, which is how they used to talk about.
He's a common man who ran the colliers. Yeah,
he was a common man, and he'd been put in charge of this. The potential for it all going wrong was huge if they didn't respect him. If they thought that he was
weak.
Yeah, if they thought he was weak. And in particular, Banks poses a problem because Banks is the kind of person who's used to getting his way. He's in charge. Yeah. He's, from aristocratic background.
Mm.
But actually on ship, it's Cook who's in charge. And I think looking at these power dynamics is interesting. I mean, I should say that on Endeavour, the best cabin should be the captain's cabin.
Which is above deck or is it below?
It goes off
the
great cabin at the back. And there was a particular one. And who went into that cabin?
Banks.
Of course, Banks did. So Cook was relegated to a side cabin for one of the lieutenants. So you see that power dynamic was confused from the beginning.
But as you say, he's in charge.
You know, it's just as I say, Cook, he grows in stature as the voyage goes. And actually, Banks realizes that he can't do without this person. And if you're going to put your life in the hands of someone,
then you better really have a steadfast man. And the time when people's lives are most at risk at this time in history is rounding the horn.
Yeah.
And so as they get to the horn, what is the situation and the condition of the ship and its crew?
It's fine. I mean, they're going well. They have this moment where they stop in Rio and have a row with the local authorities. And then they go down.
A bad row.
Really bad row. Yeah. For the reason I told you, because the Portuguese viceroy doesn't believe that it's an exploration vessel. They said, we're going off to measure the transit of Venus. Oh, yeah, pull the other one. But what are you actually doing here? No one trusts the British.
In many ways, it is quite fair because often exploration voyages from France, England and Russia are spies going out. Yeah. I mean, they're not doing what they say they're going to be
so
doing.
That's a really an annoying diplomatic incident. But they go around Cape Horn pretty well. I mean, those of you who've read David Grand's book On the Wager this year, which had been one of the big books about maritime life in the 18th century, will know about Anson's voyage, which happened. It was the big one before the Endeavour one, basically. And I think 2/3 of the people on Anson's voyage died.
Right.
Like 2/3. That's a mortality rate which is higher than the Somme.
So they round the horn, that's fine. They managed to do that with great aplomb.
Banks manages to get ashore and gets
what he wants as well. But how long before they reach the Pacific Islands, which is really what makes this voyage immortal?
Yeah, so points out how good Cook is, because he follows his orders and he actually arrives in Tahiti, which is where... there's a whole backstory to this as well, but this is the place which the British call George's Island. Mm. You know, the British were very fond of crowning new things George.
When they discovered a planet in the 1780s,
they called it George.
There was a planet called George.
Yeah, that was Uranus. Yeah,
Uranus was called George.
Yeah, to begin with. Yeah, that's what the British first called.
Can I just say, I find that just utterly delightful.
Yeah. I think we should always call Uranus George from now on.
And so they were heading to this island that they had called George's Island, which is in the middle of the South Seas, perfect for transit observations.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't called George's Island. First person to get the proper name of the island is my friend Sidney Parkinson. He says it's called Otaheite. Actually, like, the O is an article, so it's actually just Tahiti, but they persisted with calling it Otaheite for a long time. Right in the middle of the South Seas, in an area that we call the Society Islands, French Polynesia is its name today, and that's where the transit observations happened in, I think, June of 1769.
And how do they, you know, in the first meeting with the people who have lived in Tahiti/Otaheite/George, what are they like? What do they describe them as being like?
There had been some voyages earlier that had landed.
I mean, this is a really fascinating bit of history that Anne Salmon, the New Zealand historian, has written about at length. And I would suggest people go and have a look at those books if they're very interested. But there's a series of encounters which happen on the voyages. The Society Islands, I'll call these ones, form the first series of encounters. And there had been some voyages that went through in the years before. Firstly, by Bougainville.
After whom Bougainville is named.
Yeah, and before that, sorry, there was a voyage of Byron who went. But I'm not sure Byron saw Tahiti, but Wallace, who also went in the Dolphin, the same ship, did. So and you can imagine, and Anne Salmon describes these islanders as living a life of cosmic loneliness in the middle of the certificate.
Cosmic loneliness.
Yeah, it's a beautiful phrase, which just stays with me, where you are alone in this watery world, you know. And the Polynesians, who are the greatest seafarers in human history by miles, I mean, whatever the Imperial British did is nothing in comparison to that great question of how there was a colonial wave from Hawaii to New Zealand. I mean, how did that happen? That's a bonkers thing. But it happened because of Polynesian seafaring.
Okay.
And the period of long distance voyaging had stopped in about the year 1400. And then these strange vessels start turning up.
Okay, so what do they say about, you know, the first time, you know, first contact, as we call it? What does Banks say about it? What does Cook say about it? And what does your man, Parkinson, say about it?
Yeah, I think one thing that everyone points out is the vividness of the colours. When you're in the middle of the Pacific, it's the kind of the turquoise blues of the water, you know, different areas of colour in the water, the jade green of the mountains which rise up from the sea. These kind of things are very prominent. One thing that modern science has actually added to our understanding of these accounts is that often the sailors were quite scurvied by this point.
Scurvy has
a weird effect on the functioning of the human brain. And one thing that we know now is it's kind of like a sensory distortion thing. So often it's a bit like finding out about unreliable narrator in fiction, finding out about these voyaging accounts, because what they were seeing was obviously pretty striking. If you and I went to Bora Bora or Tahiti today, we go, well, this is pretty, you know, pretty intense. But what they were seeing then was probably heightened by the fact that they were starved of vitamin C.
Hang on a minute, what does scurvy do? What does scurvy doolally look like when you're looking at something?
So this is all very new research, and this is something that I found fascinating when I was writing the book. There's a disturbance of the sensory modulators, basically, in the brain. So
like taking LSD?
Yeah. It's almost like taking drugs. And you, in a way, there's a disruption of serotonin and dopamine. Right. So you get people acting in quite irrational ways and looking at things. So that even Cook himself, he was very like on a level.
Yeah,
even he goes a bit strange at some points. And nowadays, with modern science, people have looked afresh at these documents and said, actually, we think he might be scurvied at this point.
Okay, so we know what they thought. It was vivid, it was beautiful. Did they talk about the people that they met?
Very much so. And they interact with them very closely.
Yeah, exactly. So these preceding voyages, Bougainville and Wallace, had established some form of meaningful connection between the two. You've got to imagine that the Europeans saw the Tahitians in very cartoonish 2D varieties. They talked of Queen Oberea as being this kind of beneficent queen who overruled the island, and it was a land of sexual plenty and all the rest of this.
Banks makes particular.
Yeah, so, I mean, they give lots of these people names from ancient Rome. So you get lots of, it's almost like the slavery story where you find lots of Pompeys and Catos and Caesars come up in their account because it's an ideal landscape. They don't have the vocabulary or the means to understand it. But there's another side to this story as well, which is what the Tahitians made of these British voyagers coming in. And
is there any written record?
No written records, but there's lots of oral histories, and these have like kind of passed down, and we do have quite good understanding now.
They found them very dirty because the Tahitians were famously clean, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Think things like this. And I think one of the most interesting ethnographic parts of it is Parkinson again, who creates a word list from Tahiti. He goes to quite considerable lengths to actually watch the ceremonies as taking place and trying to decode them. And so he ponders very interestingly about, so for example, as the British think that the Tahitians are great thieves.
Based on what?
The fact they steal a lot of things off the ship.
Okay.
But then Parkinson looks at their dwellings and says, well, there's no locks on their doors, so they can't steal from each other. So that's a kind of example of like how Parkinson is quite,
He's a deeper thinker.
Different attitudes to property is what it actually is.
Yeah, and I mean, this is also at the time of Rousseau when there's lots of speculation about noble savage and barbarity and civility.
More on the oral tradition, though. I mean, more on what we know of what people thought, apart from being smelly and dirty. What else did they think about these people who'd come from across the sea in these strange vessels?
I think there's always a temptation, because there are descriptions which have come down of people saying that there was like a floating cloud coming in. It's like an alien ship coming in, or a house full of divinities, or all the rest of this. There's lots of these descriptions of the Endeavour which are rich and they're exotic. But actually, I think very soon after this, they would have actually realised that it was a very big canoe, basically, or a pahi.
Okay.
And actually, in Parkinson's word list, one thing I noticed, I was looking through, Parkinson's obviously eliciting words from one of the Tahitians, and he asks the word for a canoe, and they say pahi, and then he asks the word for ship, which is the next one down. Presumably, he's pointing at Endeavour and saying, well, what would you call that? And they say pahi. So they think it's a canoe. So they're not
that impressed.
No, a big canoe.
Big canoe. Okay, right.
And one of them joins the voyage.
Yeah, and the most extraordinary characters of the 18th century, Tupaia, Polynesian star navigator, gets onto Endeavour, leaves with them. Mm. I mean, this is after the transit observations have been taken. So that part of the voyage is pretty much done.
Achieved, ticked off. Yeah,
to a degree. And then, so now they're onto the Dalrymple leg.
So in September 1699, Endeavour becomes the first European vessel to reach the islands off New Zealand for 127 years.
Yeah, so New Zealand at this point was the one certain landmass that people knew existed down there at some point.
They'd somehow managed to get to New Zealand before they got recognised that they'd found a continent.
Australia. And there was a great schism on board. Some people thought this was a coast of the great southern continent that Dalrymple had predicted.
I really do feel sorry for Dalrymple now.
He's sitting in New Hales outside Edinburgh. It's winter, and there's ice out of the gutters. He's hearing all these stories, imagining all these stories are going to be happening.
I think that's pretty true. And so you get the other party, which is like the Cook ones, who say this is actually just New Zealand, it's part of an island. But so that landmass of New Zealand isn't understood by European maps at all.
Who'd been there already? The Dutch had been there.
Tasman went there in 1642, yeah. I think. There'd been a very brief, violent episode with the Maori.
Did he go anywhere beyond Tasmania? Or, I mean, did they know the scale of it? Was there a shape of New Zealand on the map?
Not really. There was like a kink on a map. And there was, I think, the encounter between a Tasman and the Maori. I mean, it happened in a place that was called Murderer's Bay. I think that's right. And it was very brief. It was like, it wasn't meaningful in any sense. And this is, again, a story which kind of repeated when Endeavour makes it to New Zealand. They get to this place on the eastern coast of the North Island called Gisborne today.
Yeah.
The Maori called it Turanga Nui a Kiwa, and that's where a pretty infamous encounter with the Maori happens.
So what happens? So Cook's guys go onto land. The Maori meet them. They meet them in friendship or they meet them in war.
The relationship in the Society Islands had been pretty friendly.
Very friendly. Yeah.
Yeah, very friendly. Lots of relationships were forged of different types, and I won't go into all of them now. But the Maori were a different cast of character. They were
warriors.
They were warriors. Yeah, there was an important part of that was part of their culture. But some absolutely extraordinary things happened in Taranga Nui, which is still talked about today. First of all, there's a shooting which happens very soon after the Endeavour arrives, which results in the death of a Maori man called Tim Maro. And that shot is still debated in New Zealand to this day, whether it was an act of self-defence or violence or whatever. And I'll leave that to one side for the moment today, because I know we've got lots to get through. But shortly after this, you have this moment where the Endeavour crew come ashore and they try to do what they did in Tahiti, which is to establish some kind of relationship so they can take water and things back on board. And they line up on the opposite sides of a river, which is, I think, the Tairanga Nui River. So one side, the Maori, the other side, you have the Endeavour crew. In the middle of this river is a rock. And, you know, this is a kind of very loaded moment in encounter history. And you get Cook. I mean, first of all, they see a haka, the first haka ever witnessed by British crew.
I mean, if anyone doesn't know, but I'm sure everyone knows, it's that war dance and rugby fixtures now most commonly seen at. But yeah.
And then an unknown Maori man comes onto the rock and Cook comes onto the rock. And there's a moment, I think, before that when Tupaia translates between the two, so he kind of ameliorates
the language in Tahiti.
So this is
again, but I mean, what a weird moment in European history, or in world history, sorry, where you have someone like Tupaia trying to bridge two cultures that he's not part of with a language that surprisingly works. Anyway, then Cook and this unknown Maori man stand together and they have a hongi, which is a joining of two breaths into one body, the traditional Maori greeting. Which
is basically a kiss, is it?
Well, it's rubbing
it's
noses.
It's when you rub noses together.
Rubbing noses, the hongi.
And so, you know, and then this situation from being quite promising then descends into violence.
Do we know what happened? Or is it mis...
Yeah, I think what's recorded by the British is there is a moment of theft. So someone has a hanger stolen from them. And then
a hanger?
This is a kind of sword, a small sword.
Right. Okay.
Which is the kind of thing that I suppose would be stolen in a situation like this. The Maori have no idea of gunpowder at this point, and one of them is shot. And then there's a kind of general retreat. After that, Cook does something which is quite foolish, where he kidnaps some people, which he thought he was going to take as a kind of bargaining tool. It's described by his shipmates as a good Christian-like activity. I don't see, and even Cook himself said it was a really bad idea. This ends up in a skirmish because the Maori fight back. And there's, I think Cook said three or four people are killed in this skirmish in Taranga Nui a Kiwa. And it's just, I always think that's very revealing that Cook, who's the most precise person in the world, is into approximation, that he can't actually look squarely in the eye at what happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that, and also important to say, you know, people talk about Cook being this great explorer and navigator. But New Zealand, he's seen very much as a bit of a murdering bastard.
This is a very important thing to acknowledge in this voyage, that it is seen as the end of olden times. Mm. This is the language language that's often used, and the beginning of a painful new history.
And this is also an important moment when Cook gets back. We should say that he is censored by certain people.
Yeah, I think actually this is the point which is worth mentioning Dalrymple, because he had, sorry if I can do this again, but
yes, no, please go ahead.
There's a few things that he said, which I think you should be proud of, actually. One of which was that no accession should be made to the British Empire by fraud or violence. Mm. And this was one thing that he was very... So if the British Empire was to expand, it was to do so...
Honourably.
Honourably. Mm-hmm. How that was to happen, I don't know. Second thing that I always think showed him in a very, very good light is that he had very high standards for how people should treat both Indigenous people and Indigenous knowledge. So, for example, he hated Cook's habit of renaming places. Because that was a cultural vandalism.
Right. Oh, God, I like Dalrymple. Yeah. He's all right.
So yeah. He said, well, why are we calling this place Poverty Bay when it's already called Taranganui Akiwa? Which is, right. So again, you see him as actually...
For his time.
Yeah, no, really very nice.
Well, I just think this was the Pacific, the absolute episode, which, and Cook admitted that he screwed up. He said, you know, in his own journal, he said, I made a mistake. And later, when they got back in Britain... Dalrymple said that, you know, Cook was incompetent on many levels, and he was not only incompetent, he was a murderer. And that was, you know, that was...
It's a serious charge.
Very serious. And with any legal backup or just something where they're basically hitting each other around the face with gloves?
A bit of both.
Have you ever known a Dalrymple charge into an accusation without thinking of the consequences? I don't know. It's one of those, but it was a pretty serious thing. So I think those two perspectives are worth sharing.
But Cook never accepted that he'd done anything wrong.
I think Cook did accept that he did something wrong, yeah. I think he said in his journals that, I know I will be censored for this, but he said... Having got myself into the situation, was I to stand around and let myself get hit over the head? That was his kind of point.
So from New Zealand, and I think we'll probably talk about this in the next half of this, how long before sights are set on Australia, and do they know they're heading for something called Australia?
Well, not really, not in the sense that we think of Australia. Again, geography is very patchy. They have this idea of a landmass, well, they know about Tasmania or Tasman's land or whatever, Van Diemen's land, I think it was called at the time. And then above that, they knew there was somewhere called New Holland, which is the place that the Dutch generally collided with when they were on the way to Batavia or something.
Zealand is in Denmark, so I don't know quite how it ended up being named after the Danes.
Ask me questions, I'm not sure. So they had to decide how to get back. They are almost at the opposite side of the world. You know, when you get to New Zealand, you've gone a very, very long way.
I'd love
to tell you more about the New Zealand portion, because it is really interesting. But essentially, they have to decide how to get back. And Cook decides that he's going to go and fall in with the coast of New Holland, go north, get to Batavia, and then come back across the Indian Ocean on a very familiar route. By that point, you're fine.
Okay.
At this point, they're completely off the charts.
So I love this. Okay, we'll go into the break now. Join us after the break when we put a coastline to that bit of gap in the middle of the map.
Aber was ich noch erzählen wollte, meine Nichte kämpft sich ja ganz schön durchs Studium. Semesterbeitrag, Laptop, Bücher, Software, Handy, Internet. Ey, so ein Master ist echt teuer.
Ach, sag ihr, sie kann sich das zurückholen.
Ja, du meinst von der Steuer absetzen, ne? Aber sie verdient ja nicht.
Egal, Zauberwort Verlustvortrag. Macht sie ganz einfach mit Wieso Steuer. Und wenn sie dann arbeitet, heißt es Katsching.
Das geht?
Safe, Wieso Steuer.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück.
Jetzt kostenlos ausprobieren.
Mama, wie fühlt sich die große Liebe an?
Süß, zart und so cremig.
Hä? Wie kann denn Papa cremig sein?
Nutella wurde von Mama schon vor Papa geliebt. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Welcome back. So, we were talking with Peter Moore about this discovery of the gap in the map, which has a place called Australia, we now know it as. Tell us about the journey of Cook to Australia, and is it simple or straightforward
disastrous? We should just say at this point that they're not sure what they're looking for. No. What they've got on their charts is odd bits of land. They've got Tasmania, they've got Zealand, and they're expecting to find possibly a great southern continent, an enormous landmass, and they don't know whether all these bits join up.
So, I mean, there's a huge degree of uncertainty, and Cook's got this idea that he wants to fall in, I think that's his language, with what would be the eastern coast of this and work its way up. But, you know, all this idea we have about Australia today is not really understood. And so very soon after the New Zealand portion, he does cross the Tasman Sea, gets over to the east coast of Australia. They spend a bit of time in Botany Bay. And this is where that first landing point is. So in Australian history, this is often seen as a coming of the British
moment. A watershed moment.
But of course, we have to say that this is not the beginning of Australian history. It's 50,000 years since the Aboriginal
people were there first.
50,000 years.
As much as that, and the world's longest continuous civilization is this, with, you know, this kind of strange moment in 1770 where the British turn up. So again, we have this third area of encounter. We've had the Society Islands, if you like.
New Zealand,
Maori, and then New Holland, which won't acquire its name Australia for another few generations or until about 1800 with Flinders. What happens here as well, if you characterise the friendliness in Tahiti, the violence maybe in New Zealand, there's something more unsettling for the British crew, particularly for people like Banks in Australia, because they're met with a kind of apathy. So the Aboriginal people they meet, they don't understand them. They don't accept their gifts. They will often ignore them. They won't regard the ship as a machine of any particular significance. And this really throws them.
This really muddles them. They don't know what's going on.
And so in, to the sense they actually prefer the Maori because they can understand that reaction.
They understand the fight. Yeah,
they can understand the fight. Yeah. But they can't understand the apathy.
What do you put the apathy down to? Or what is there any oral tradition that explains what they were thinking?
They just wanted them to go away. To distill a long process of oral history. They were watching. It was a wholly different culture which had arisen over such a huge portion of time. So if you think about the ship going up a mile away from the shore, there might be a mile between the ship and the shore. But there's something like 50,000 years of divergent human history between in that space. It's incredible. And you think the people who just don't understand each other at all. And we're talking about a specific enlightenment culture that Banks exemplifies of gathering, of expanding. Mm. And sometimes I have to admit, when I was reading Banks's journal, you really cringe.
It's uncomfortable because he's thinking of human beings as specimens. And as, you know, nothing, there is nothing tender,
it's
human.
It is that colonial instinct.
You have a very complex picture of Banks in the book, and you're quite fond of him personally, but he shows himself in his least colours at this point.
This great ambivalence. You wouldn't want to be dogmatic about it, because I think you can see how you could turn this into a flag-waving history, and I never wanted to do that. I think this is a story of different perspectives, and that's why for the subtitle I chose this, The Ship and Attitude That Changed the World. But changed is an ambivalent word, you know, it's ambiguous. It could mean change for the better or change for the worse.
And for these guys, it definitely wasn't for the better.
No. And a lot of, almost everyone in the Polynesian heritage would say that this was not a good moment for them.
No, disastrous. Okay, so they come on board, they're ignored. At what point what does Cook do while he's there? If they're just saying, la, 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 can't hear you, and just ignoring them and wanting to go.
Can I tell you? One of the things that I think is so this has been handed down in oral memory by the Bachala people of Kagari or Fraser Island. This is a really haunting song poem. And this is them looking out at the Endeavour as it went up the eastern coast. And it says, strangers are travelling with a cloud, Ari Ram. It has fire inside. It must be a bad water spirit. It's stupid, maybe. It's going directly to that rainbow serpent place. This is the truth that I bring. It's breathing smoke rhythmically from its rear. It must be songmen and sorcerers. Coming up and going back with the wind at its rear. It's like a sand crab. The sea carries the ship here. Why?
And do we know how old that is? I mean, it's just old.
One of these which has been passed down in oral memory. So there's lots of complexities there of how that evidence should be treated. And it's probably subject to all sorts of dispossession narratives which have happened over time. But it's kind of the best we've got. And you have to always imagine people looking out at this ship and wondering what
was
happening.
It's a very, very interesting moment. And this is that one that we've come across in previous episodes of Empire. This is a bit like the Balfour Declaration. For Jewish people, it's a moment of a whole new world opens up, a state is about to be born. For the Palestinians, it's the Nakba, it's the catastrophe. The same is true here. This is the beginnings of the modern nation of Australia. For many Europeans, this is a new life, a new world, a whole new horizon. For the people that are living there, it's a catastrophe.
It's awful.
And it follows a century of shrinking and shrinking, of reduction of rights, of kidnapping of children, diseases, and that familiar process of encounter with Europe, which leads to every kind of disaster.
How long is Cook there, and what does he do while he's there?
So he just spends these few months on the eastern coast. But we're talking about encounters. One of the most significant encounters is with the Great Barrier Reef, because they sail straight into the thing.
And this is a crucial moment. You paint it as a moment of enormous sort of
the
ship has literally seesawing. It's one of these
inflection moments, isn't it, in history where things could have gone
very differently.
Very differently. Mm. And they're very lucky.
This is where the acorn and the quality of wood comes in.
We got there.
Okay, so tell us why this is important.
So the ship gets caught on the coral.
Gets caught on a coral, it grinds, the coral grinds at the ship's hull, it goes down a tide, so the pressure is increasing all the time. They have to wait till the tide comes up. Cook decides that he's going to basically drag the ship off the coral.
And he has to jettison stuff, doesn't he? Throw it out.
Yeah, but that would have been, I mean, had the ship sunk at that point, that would have been the end. Though no one would have heard, no one would have known.
What they've done, and, where they've been.
And surely the history of Australia might have been different. But all of Banks' specimens that he'd been collecting by this point, they would have all gone. Anyway, they do manage to get it to...
How'd they get off?
Well, they wait for the high tide, so the maximum pressure upwards, and then they kind of pull it off. And they're very lucky because a bit of the coral is stuck in the hull, and it kind of plugs the leak.
Scratch the hole,
and then they do this thing where they kind of plaster the ship up with a technique called fothering, where they tie a sail underneath, and the pressure of the water pushes the sail.
Pushes out,
it's a very clever thing to do.
Clever.
They managed to take it into the
dry dock almost, isn't it?
Yeah, this river, which again, this is colonial because this river is now known as Endeavour River. Warrumbobiri, I think, is its proper name. But there's another series of encounters here with the Aboriginal people, which very lucky again, the Endeavour, because where they bring this ship into beach is a sacred ground where no blood is to be spilled. So the story goes. So they're not really in the danger that they might have been elsewhere. But this is where this famous moment happens, where they encounter a kangaroo for the first time. And no one has the vocabulary to describe this creature, which says, Your Majesty, what are these hopping past? You think, what the hell is that? So there's lots of funny explanations in journals saying, well, we think it's a hare or it's a deer or whatever. And so they have the kangaroo there. Actually, more dangerously than the reef, the first encounter with the reef is the second ones, when they go back out to sea, because they have to get through this whole coral sea. I don't know if you spent time on the Great Barrier Reef, but that whole Queensland coast is just completely
a nightmare to sail through.
Cook never went back. He got out of there as quickly as he could, but actually, like, weaving through all of these reefs was really hair-raising, and they thought that they'd had it a number of times, and
But they bandage up the ship. They managed to sort of band-aid it up with a sail. I mean, I love that detail of it. And then they are on the return. Are they then resolved? And now they've gone as far as they can, and they've got to go home.
Yeah, I think, like, at this point, there's just two last things I have to tell you.
They get to Batavia, which is modern Jakarta, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And when you go to Jakarta today, there's the old area of Batavia where there's a wonderful museum of seafaring and with all the...
But this is really where they have, in a way, the most deadly portion of the voyage, because a lot of these sailors are taken ill at Batavia, where there's a very bad climate, I suppose.
This always happens throughout colonial history, malaria and dysentery.
And
Batavia
is
notorious.
Exactly. Like, Cook reproached himself mostly because he'd brought most people safely around all of these free reefs and around islands, around Cape Horn. Most people died at Batavia. And Sidney Parkinson dies there, for example.
Tupaia. Leaving all his pictures behind.
The Star Navigator. Yeah. Oh, right.
As I say that, I mean, his history itself is
an extraordinary story.
Extraordinary.
The weird thing is, in a sense, that the Dutch, having got as far as Batavia, turn it into their capital, but never go and explore or try and draw maps of these reefs.
Do you know what I should tell you, actually? Press a Dalrymple button here. Because there was this great question. So the world is like a big maze, basically. And when you put the winds on top of that, then it's actually quite like, kind of going between some places is very easy, going between others is very difficult. So Cook was the very first who really went across the Pacific that way. It was easier to go the other way. And it's not quite right, but in broad terms, it might be. And he was the first person to go up the eastern coast of Australia. Now, but how did he get up from the Coral Sea to Batavia? And he went through a passage that was in Dalrymple's book. which I told you, if you remember before. Gosh. It's actually, I think it's called the Torres Strait.
The notes that he handed over. Strait,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And but was, for that, and Cook acknowledges this, doesn't he?
Yeah, and so, and Dalrymple, when he finds out about this, is just incandescent, so because not only has Cook taken his voyage,
he's taken his maps, taken he's his got glory. Home thanks to his...
He's found, he used his passage.
So the ship is now home. Does it come home to a hero's welcome? Does Cook get sort of lifted onto everyone's shoulders? And is the Endeavour then thought of as this amazing part of history then and there?
You'd have thought that might be the way it goes. Kind of right, yeah, actually. Cook is promoted captain, becomes Captain Cook for true. He's in reality, and he is poised to go on two further voyages. So that's a separate history, which ends with his death in Hawaii on Valentine's Day in 1779. Banks is the celebrity. He is he's Lord of Rome. He's the rock and roll star, and
because he knows how to do PR while Captain Cook is reticent and Yorkshire.
Exactly. The ship itself
keeps quiet.
The ship itself is pretty much forgotten.
No point in talking about it.
But nobody wants to turn nobody wants to turn the ship into a museum or a monument or nothing.
Repurposed. So what happens is it's sent out again on new commissions. So again, as Endeavour, it goes down to Falkland Islands a couple of times. And comes back from that. And I think its life would have been pretty much at an end, because it was pretty worn out by this point. It had been through
the Barrier Reef.
The Barrier Reef had been through it.
Yes.
But then this last, and this is the thing that I'll kind of end with in a way, because this is the twist in the tale. Because
this
the
is
story,
part of your discovery.
Yeah. Well, not mine. I won't claim this, but it's not as well known. Let's put it that way. The ship was then renamed the Lord Sandwich, and it was commissioned as a troop carrier. Now, in 1775, 1776, we all know what was happening then.
American War of Independence.
Interesting in America, yeah.
The biggest logistic problem in your world history to that point is, how do you take a British army from Britain across the Atlantic in such massive numbers? And this Endeavour was renamed Lord Sandwich, and it sailed to New York Harbour in 1776 with all these Hessian troops.
I have to say, Alexander Drimple's cousin, William Drimple, is in charge.
Oh,
but we'll pass over that.
Oh my God.
God, they can't get away from him.
Having just committed the Boston Massacre, I'm ashamed to say.
Okay. Oh, there is that your one as well?
Yeah. Oh, William Drupal. Yeah.
You can't move for tripping over them these days, I find. Okay.
Yeah.
So that, and it ends its life there as a
and
troop carrier.
The very last chapter, I suppose, is in Newport, Rhode Island in Narragansett Bay, where it's used as pretty much a prison ship. And it's a pretty sad end to
this
what
great
was,
exploring vessel.
And in 1778, it's scuttled, which
the
is
French
deliberately.
The French are coming for Rhode Island.
You just talked over the saddest bit. It's scuttled, so it's basically the heart is taken out of it and it's sunk. Where's its body then?
So this has become a huge hide and seek operation over the last 20 years. It's been the subject of this investigation by people in America, by the Australian National Maritime Museum, who are very keen to find it. There's been a process of narrowing down where they found it was definitely part of one of 12, then it was part of one of 5, then they've narrowed it down to one, which you would have thought would be enough to discover it, but actually that's not the same as a positive identification, because you've got to find something. So I'm hoping my oak trees from Yorkshire might be useful one day as
identifying DNA.
Maybe. I don't know.
It's such a fabulous story, and you tell it so well, Peter. Thank you so, so much for being one of our Christmas ships. Really,
a sad ending from the Whitby coast to Newport and Rhode Island.
14 years.
It lived a life, though. Quite epic for 14 years. Peter, thank you so very much. And there's not much else to say apart from ding dong merrily on your high. Thank you so much for being with Empire. We're going to be with you after Christmas. Till then, it's goodbye and ho, ho, ho from me, Anita Arnon.
And goodbye and ding dong from me, William Driffle.
Ding dong. Bye.